We are now on. We are going to call the Property and Local Sales Tax Division to order. And Representative Hilty is here. We're going to start out right with House File 1426, Fire and Ambulance Special Taxing District Established. And so we don't have a quorum yet, but we can move these bills when we do. So if Representative Hilty, if you would present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1426 is a local bill brought to me by some of the areas that I serve in Carlton County, mainly the city of Cloquet. What it does is establish a fire and ambulance taxing district between the city of Cloquet and Perch Lake Township. Hopefully at some point this would include many of the other areas that are currently served by the ambulance service and the fire department in the city of Cloquet. Mr. Chair, I know you have an ambitious agenda this morning, and so we'll cut right to the chase and ask the Cloquet City Administrator, Mr. Brian Tristinger, and Fire Chief from the City of Cloquet, Jim Langenbrenner, to give us a little history of the kind of unique situation that they find themselves in and why we're proposing this as a solution.
Representative Hilty, thank you very much. If you would proceed, state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, I'm Brian Tristinger, City Administrator with the City of Cloquet. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you here today to talk to you about the bill. I'll begin with some general background about Cloquet and the fire district that we're looking at here, and then turn it over to Chief Langenbrenner to talk about some more of the specifics as to why it's important for us. In terms of Cloquet, for those of you who are not familiar with us, we're a community about 11,500 north, just south of Duluth, Minnesota, and we have by all means are afforded and looked at as a regional center in that context with a number of the services that we provide that part of the state. In this capacity, one of the things that we have been historically providing to Carlton County and parts of St. Louis County is advanced life support from an ambulance standpoint, as well as full-time fire for the city of Cloquet and some of our other adjacent townships. We operate that ambulance service through a mandated PSA, or primary service district, that the state looks at us and tells us where we have to provide that ambulance service to. The primary service area that we provide ambulance protection within is about a 250 square mile area consisting of both portions of Carlton and St. Louis County. So it's a fairly large area outside of our normal governing jurisdiction of the city of Cloquet, which is about a 36 square mile community. As a result, we're providing this service to many areas, many governing jurisdictions, and many people that aren't paying any taxes or paying any sort of fees for that service that they receive, and which obviously in terms of some of the current state budget situations as well as our local budget situations is becoming more and more of a challenge for us. And Chief Langenbrenner will talk about some of the changes over the last 10 years that have taken place that have compounded that effect for us. We have, over the last 3 years, began a process of working with the neighboring jurisdictions at the incentive of Carlton County, who brought in a consultant who worked with us, ECSI, beginning back in 2005, to analyze how we provide fire and ambulance service within this part of the state. And through that process, spent a great deal of time looking at methods to reorganize and collaborate more with our adjacent jurisdictions and come together kind of under a district format that would allow us to make change to become more cost-effective in that approach. So we have been working on that for the last 3 years. We feel the bill that we have here allows us to move in that direction. And I think that with Chief Langenbrenner here, he can describe some more of the specifics as to why it's important for us to take a look at the district that we propose.
Chief, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is James Langenbrenner. Please call me Jim. Representative Hilty. I started with the Torquay Fire Department in 1975, and in the late 70s, the state of Minnesota created what was called a primary service area, which was the state's intention to make sure that all citizens within the state are provided ambulance coverage. The reasoning at that time was that the ambulance services would be able to charge what it costs to provide the service to those receiving the service. That went well until 2002 with the federal government's efforts to balance their budget with a Balanced Budget Act, which required all ambulance services across the country to accept Medicare assignment. With that Medicare assignment, they set a level that is less than the cost of putting those rigs out the door. Medicare for an advanced life support ambulance right now reimburses about $385 for an ALS run, no matter what supplies we use, and they charge mileage. Up until this year, we received a rural mileage rate. However, the federal government, in their infinite wisdom, decided that we're an urban area now. So all of the area that we provide service to, including 11 rural townships, are classified urban. This further exasperates the problem in offsetting our collections. At the same time that the Balanced Budget Act with the Medicare assignment came in, Medicaid also follows Medicare on how they reimburse. So what we're seeing is about 70% of the people we provide service to are of either Medicare, Medicaid, or do not have insurance, so our ability to collect from them becomes even more compounded. That, recognizing that this was occurring, the city administrator with adjacent communities brought in ESCI to do the study. The study was one which they recommended a regional approach to providing fire and EMS. Some of the other communities became very nervous at the complexity of this and walked away from the table, leaving the township of Perch Lake and the city of Cloquet to continue their dialogue. They did so and we formed the Cloquet Area Fire District effective January 1 of 2009. What this legislation would allow us to do is to spread the cost of providing the service to all who receive the service, you know, within the area that the state has mandated that we provide the service to. For those areas that have the current volunteer departments, the only fees that would be assessed to those taxpayers would be for the provision of ambulance service. We would not be charging for our cost in providing fire service. At this time, we're covering over 250 square miles, plus we mutual aid with Gold Cross, which covers other adjacent areas of St. Louis County, Carlton Ambulance, which goes to the southern part of Carlton County, Cromwell Ambulance, which is to the west, and we provide mutual aid also to Floodwood. On a weekly basis, we are dispatching ALS ambulances to Floodwood, which is 35 miles away from our primary service area because they do not have crews available. What is occurring to us is occurring to our neighbors. Their ability to provide the service is becoming even more complex. We are hoping that with this language that may allow ambulances, particularly rural ambulances in our case, you know, a community providing to other communities the ability to continue providing that service.
Chief, is that a volunteer fire department in the city of Cloquet?
Cloquet was paid, was a fully paid department until January 1st of this year. We combined with Search Strike, we're a combination department now.
Okay, combination, and so you get paid salary or is it volunteer?
Both.
Okay.
We have both.
And prior to January 1st of 2009, how many townships did you have contracts with?
Contracts with for providing
fire protection.
The only township we had a contract with was Perch Lake Township,
okay, well,
and we joined together.
Maybe for the city official, Mr. Schutzinger, What are the expenses right now? I mean, how much are you would you be looking at to set a levy? I see there's no limit here. So, I mean, what are we looking at?
Mr. Chair, what the district board is looking at is basically the ability to finance 100% of the cost of the operation, which between the full-time and volunteer aspect, paid on-call aspect of the department now, is approximately $1.8 million per year.
And also, is that operations, would that include payment for pensions and so forth?
I believe that is part of the any contributions that the district will be making into the pension program would be part of that, correct?
Any other questions for Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just trying to learn. On line 1.11, it says the district may impose a tax on service provided in cities. And when I read that, at first I thought it was like a sales tax or something, but it's really, is it more like a fee? I mean, I'd always debated fees versus taxes, but I thought that was a unique reference as opposed to a charge. Just trying to understand how this works.
Mr. Fitzsinger?
Mr. Chair, Madam, under the current statutes, there is language that allows the creation of fire districts and ambulance districts that we're basically levying a tax within those areas that are part of that district. We're simply looking for that same opportunity within kind of the combined fire ambulance service area that we have here.
Okay, is there anyone, thank you very much, anyone who would like to testify for or against House File 1426? If not, thank you so much for your testimony. Representative Hilty, any last comments?
Mr. Chair, I would just say that one of the things that I think is very significant in this proposal is that there has been a great deal of interest in surrounding townships and joining this district, which would certainly be done on a voluntary basis, but it has the potential for eliminating redundancies, providing a lot better service at lower cost for all of the local units of government in this area. And Mr. Fritzinger and other officials in Carlton County have put a lot of work, a lot of discussion into this, and I think if this district is established, we will see that it does attract other local units of government to join, and I think that it has potential for being a really significant cost saver and a significant improvement in the way services are delivered in that whole part of Carlton and St. Louis County.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for coming up from Cloquet today. And I will move to lay over House File 1426 for possible inclusion into the division report. So thank you very much, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I think we have time to move to Representative Skelton's bill also. That's House File 1389. Representative Loeffler, would you like to move to lay over House File 1389 for possible inclusion?
Mr. Chairman, I would be glad to move.
All right.
The bill for possible inclusion.
And there is an amendment here. And that's being passed out. So, Representative Skelton, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate that you moved this up. It's going to be a fun week here at the legislature, and we're all scrambling. As we're passing out the A1 amendment, and the A1 amendment would get the bill in the shape that I would like to have it for the discussion purposes.
Very good. So, Representative Loeffler moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion on that? If not, we're going to vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we have with us here, too, if there's further questions, we have Eric Willett from the Department of Revenue, Gary Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities, and I have a testifier here, Mayor Mike McGuire from Egan. And basically, this bill would allow cities to levy to replace the local aids and credits that aren't already adjusted with the levy limit law that we passed last year, and it's enabling legislation. And with that, I will have Mayor Mike McGuire talk us through this bill.
Mayor McGuire, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Mike McGuire, and I'm continue to be proud to serve as the Mayor of Eagan, as well as the Chair of the Municipal Legislative Commission. Again, want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you in support of Representative Scalzi's House File 1389. As you know, the Municipal Legislative Commission is a collection of 14 metro area cities that receive no local government aid, but do, at least in theory, participate in the Homestead Market Value Credit Program. Current Minnesota state statute prohibits cities like ours from levying back losses from a partial or a complete unallotment from the state or loss of that market value credit in budget decisions. The Municipal Legislative Commission supports House File 1389 because it amends that area of statute to allow a special levy if aids or credits are lost due to unallotment or reductions enacted by the legislature in 2009 or 2010. I'll remind you that in 5 of the last 7 years, one of these things has happened, and the state has failed to reimburse communities like ours as they should, including this past December's gubernatorial allotment. With 3 days left in the local government fiscal year, these unallotments created a spontaneous deficit in Eagan and in cities and towns throughout Minnesota. We support House File 1389 and thank Representative Scalzi for offering it because we believe that local spending decisions are best made by locally elected, locally accountable officials who are, I would argue, more in touch with the local level needs and desires of their constituents and who understand the value our constituents place on a variety of services. Local governments like mine have a history and a tradition of responsible budgeting and spending. In the past, most MLC cities have not have levied below limits when they have been in place, and when they have not been in place, have used previous levy limits often as budgeting benchmarks when they budget every year. In Eagan, even when there were no levy limits, we've always measured our budgets against them. We've held truth and taxation hearings, even though levy increases have not triggered or required them. We also follow the state auditor's suggested guidelines for our cash flow and reserve accounts, and I'm particularly proud of the fact that Eagan has one of the state's lowest ratios of employees to citizens of cities with more than 50,000 residents. I want to be clear. Our MLC community support House File 1389, our MLC community support of House File 1389 should not be taken as a guarantee that our cities will levy back such losses. We're sensitive to our taxpayers' property tax burden, and this bill protects taxpayers by making the levy back language an option for cities, not a mandate to them. Some MLC cities are in a position that they may well not take advantage of a levy back option because they have available reserves, discover positive variances in budget reconciliations at the end of the year, or are simply committed to cutting services. However, we understand that there are also cities that are in between a budgetary rock and a hard place still. They continue to deal with the last-minute deficit from fiscal year 08, and are in the process of anticipating possible losses of these aids and credits for fiscal years 09 and 10. This is an important option to be available to cities so that they have the option to maintain basic and valued services for their constituencies. Finally, Mr. Chair and Committee, I would be remiss if I did not once again take this opportunity of talking to you to remind you that while we are supportive of House File 1389's option to levy back those state aids and losses, we support and encourage more fundamental reforms to the Homestead Market Value Credit Program, which direct property tax relief directly to property taxpayers in need, gets cities like mine out of the middle, and leaves our budgets and levies whole, and leaves them to us. Again, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address this bill, and I can remain available for any questions as you please.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Mr. Carlson, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities. We worked with Representative Scalzi on this bill. We do support it. We think it does accommodate cities that do lose aid that otherwise are not acknowledged through the levy limit calculation. One other comment, Representative Lanning's bill, Representative Dabney's bill that would repeal levy limits altogether would eliminate the need for this, but we think that this would provide some equity in the way levy limits are calculated to acknowledge that some of the aid cuts are not automatically passed through in the levy limit calculation.
Very good. Any questions? If not, anyone in the audience that would care to testify for or against House File 1389? Not anyone from... Representative Scalzi?
I would just like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate that you took our bill out of order and got us up here to talk about it. And we just this is enabling legislation, and we would like to assist our cities as we go through this terrible recession, and we would like to give them this tool in the toolbox.
I appreciate that very much. Representative Lambert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson addressed the question that I was going to ask is whether this bill assumed that levy limits were here or gone. And I guess the bill assumes, from what you said, Mr. Carlson, that the levy limits are still there. And in fact, if levy limits are removed, there's no need for this. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, that is correct. This would assume that if we don't get rid of levy limits through your mandate relief bill or through the Dabney repeal bill, this would, we believe, add levy authority for those cities that are affected by the cuts that are not automatically included in the levy limit bill. So your bill would eliminate the need for this language. I should have mentioned this, in Section 2, there is what we believe is a clarification in the levy limit law, where it does say on lines 4.26 that the implicit price deflator used in the levy limit calculations could not go below zero. We think that's really a clarification of law. There's a little disagreement in as to whether growth would indicate only a positive number. But again, that would not be necessary under your bill either. If we repeal levy limits, we would not need the entirety of this legislation. That's correct.
Thank you very much. I am going to lay over House File 1389 for possible inclusion into the division report. Thank you very much, and thank you, testifiers.
Thank you so much.
We're going to hear Representative Morgan's bill next. House File 1676. Anyone care to move that? Representative Dietrich moves House File 1676 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Morgan, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And again, I like Representative Scalzi, I appreciate you agreeing to take this out of order to make it easier on my testifier. House File 1676 provides a degree of protection from loss of state reimbursements like the market value homestead credit to cities who are net payers into the fiscal disparities pool. It is a situation that we are looking ahead prospectively to some possible cuts, possible further unallotments in this area, and we are looking for some protections to cities like Burnsville and many others around the metro area who are net payers into the fiscal disparities pool. I have with me City Manager Craig Eagling from Burnsville to help give some context to how the fiscal disparities pool and the market value homestead credit and so forth has impacted a city like Burnsville. Keep in mind there are many other cities in the metro area that would benefit or be hurt less, perhaps, if this language were adopted.
Very good. Please proceed and please state your name.
My name, for the record, is Craig Eagling. I'm City Manager of the City of Burnsville. Thank you for the opportunity to appear today and to speak a couple words about some factors that impact our city as it does a few others. We are a subset of cities who are net losers from the fiscal disparities law and also have experienced the severe impacts of non-reimbursement of market value homestead credit. We've distributed a very simple chart to you that demonstrates our experience over the last 5 years. That chart is a bar chart that combines the losses that we've experienced through the fiscal disparities pool along with the losses due to the lack of reimbursement for the market value homestead credit program. And those bars are stacked on top of each other, and I would
point out the fact that over the last 5 years, we've experienced a cumulative loss of approximately $14 million. What does that mean to a community the size of Burnsville? That's more than half of our annual levy, more than half of our annual tax levy. The bill, as we understand it, as proposed by Representative Morgan, would afford some small level of protection from future losses of market value homestead credit reimbursement. And our estimate is shown in 2009 in the green bar in the order of magnitude of $600,000 or $700,000. What would that mean to our city? That would mean 10 policemen. We are in the process now of adjusting our budget for 2009 to deal with our unallotment at the end of 2008 and the potential loss of market value homestead credit reimbursement, and we are struggling with exactly those kinds of issues. Police and fire positions will certainly be on our list of potential cuts, as well as public works and other essential functions of the city. In summary, again, this will provide some level of protection for a subset of cities across the metropolitan area who are severely impacted by the combination of these two state programs. I'd be happy to respond to questions. I also have our Deputy City Manager and Chief Finance Officer, Tammy Amdahl, with us today too, to better respond.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, in your testimony you said that many communities would be would benefit from this. How many communities in the metro area would benefit by this law being passed?
Representative Morgan.
Or maybe if Representative Morgan doesn't recall that number, perhaps we could ask all staff.
I do not recall the exact number. I can give you some examples of some of the cities I remember off the top of my head, if that would be helpful, Representative Garofalo.
No. Yeah. Maybe how staff...
Representative Garofalo?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps staff could... I think we got the spreadsheet emailed to us, and I think I know what the number is, but it may be important for the committee to know that.
And this, of course, does relate to the Representative Lucheski's bill a little bit that she brought forward the other day on the fiscal disparity study, so it's kind of the same issue. But Mr. Hines, do you have a...
Mr. Chair, I just got it. Could you repeat the question? I was trying to pull together a printout, and I got 98% of the way. I thought I had until 6 o'clock. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the those who, under this bill, if you are a net contributor to fiscal disparities, you pay more in than you get back, and you had your market value or LGA cut, you could actually have that basically you'd be protected from having your cut. So I'm thinking every metropolitan community gets market value homestead credit. So how many people, how many cities are net contributors in the metro area to fiscal disparities?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, I don't have the exact number, but it's in the neighborhood of 36 cities that are net contributors in the metro, that are net contributors.
Really? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Maybe I didn't. That's why you shouldn't ask questions you think you know the answer to, right? I guess. Okay. And then, sorry, Mr. Chairman, thank you to the staff. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Mr. Hines, I just counted that I get like 22.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. 22, right? That number.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Morgan, where this is, and then I understand this, why not just have these communities not contribute as much to fiscal disparities as they do right now? Why would that not be a preferred strategy?
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, certainly another strategy, not one, perhaps one that was, I thought, a bigger hurdle to get over, or a bigger bite of the apple than I was willing to take with my perspective on tax policy.
Morgan, why is
Representative
that?
Representative Garofalo.
Why is that? Why is that a bigger apple?
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I think most people want, most people that I know in these cities that are net payers into fiscal disparities would certainly appreciate a study of the fiscal disparity law as it is. I guess my perspective as somebody who does not sit on a tax committee or the property tax division, I didn't feel that, I felt perhaps we had a better chance getting something like this passed into law that would provide the protections that are important and necessary without storming the Bastille of fiscal security law.
Representative Garofalo? That's my last question. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, isn't this just really taking from poor communities like Lakeville and giving to rich communities like Burnsville? Isn't that what this bill is about? It's about redistributing places that are hurting, like Farmington and Lakeville, and giving to big, rich cities like Bloomington and Burnsville. Isn't that what this is about?
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I think it's interesting that Representative Garofalo would lump Bloomington into the situation with Burnsville. I think that's a very interesting choice of Representative Garofalo. I think Representative Garofalo, I think residents of cities like Bloomington and Burnsville and Eden Prairie and Minnetonka and many of the other cities around the metro area who are net contributors to the fiscal disparities pool respect the idea of shared sacrifice that the fiscal disparities pool has subjected them to over these many years. And in these times when budgets are tight, when property taxpayers are feeling the pinch, I see this as an opportunity to shield some of the property taxpayers that I represent from some of these cuts in market value homestead credit that are going to have a real impact on their family budgets.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hines has a question on that number yet, so he's still calculating.
Mr. Hines. Mr. Chair, calculating is a kind word. I was counting, and I had a, this was a two-sided, I didn't catch it, so now we're up to 46.
46
is like two dozen in Hennepin County and 22 in the other counties. The Hennepin County's page was missing the first time I
counted.
Representative Loughlin, basically that's cities only, so there are some townships that are also net contributors, but this is just cities.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the spirit of expanding our property tax relief provisions, I think, speaking of Hennepin County, that if you're really going to provide property tax relief to a broader segment, you would include the counties in the same protection. And that would provide a much more interesting set of printouts for Mr. Hines to create. But I must say, you did go a little far in the drafting of this, Representative Morgan, because not only did you protect the net contributors, but you explicitly said everyone else would be subject to cuts. Right, you had to put that last thing in there.
Anyone that from the audience would care to testify for or against House File 1676? If not, any last comments there, Representative Morgan?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the committee's consideration, and again, thank you very much for proving up our testimony.
And I appreciate you sticking up for your constituents. So that's very good.
Thank you.
Representative Dietrich will move to lay over House File 1676 for possible inclusion in the division report. So
thank
you very much, and thank you, Mr. Ebeling, for your testimony today. So thank you. Representative Dietrich, you would move
Okay, members, as Representative Marquardt is making his way to the testifying table, we are going to be looking at House File 2020, which I would just point everybody's attention to is the year. Think of the number 2020 and Representative Marquardt just putting on his visionary glasses and getting, just coincidentally getting that magic number 2020. So, Representative Marquardt, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
I would. I'd like to move House File 2020 be laid over for possible inclusion into the division report.
Okay, and Representative Representative Marquardt, would you like to move your amendment labeled H-2020-A1?
Madam Chair, I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Any discussion to the amendment? Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevailed. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Marquardt, would you like to proceed with your bill?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Members, we are facing a $6.4 billion deficit, which is the highest number we have ever seen in the state of Minnesota. And at the same time, last Thursday or Friday, a report came out that in the state of Minnesota, we lost another 13,000 jobs in the month of February, which has pushed our unemployment rate over 8%. And our chief economist says that before things bottom out, we're going to lose about 120,000 jobs around the state. Since 2002, property taxes have gone up over $3 billion across the state, including an increase of 86% on homeowners. And the governor's proposal in property tax aids and credit cuts in his own department, they say it will increase property taxes by about $245 million in 2010. At the same time, we're looking at service cuts and loss of essential service cuts in law enforcement and fire and streets and human services across the state. So we were looking at a bill. As we looked at this, and Representative Romcheski and I and others were looking at how can we address all of these concerns that are impacting the economy and quality of life of our state, and at the same time balance the budget. And so what we're proposing here is an option for counties. And this would be an option for counties to be able to recoup the cuts the governor's making, which is about $116 million to counties in the second year, and that is if they don't go along with the regional pairing and stuff. But we're saying we're going to give counties the option that rather than just raising property taxes to make up for that, we're going to allow them to impose a 1/2 cent sales tax, which would be subject to reverse referendum. Now, here's what we think this would do. First of all, it provides local control. At the same time, it would eliminate the need for counties to raise property taxes to make up those cuts that the governor's plan would otherwise require. So this is going to provide property tax relief. We think it will save about 1,500 jobs just related to counties and cities that would otherwise be lost according to the governor's proposal. It will protect property tax owners and protect essential services. At the same time, also be able to save about $100 million a year to our budget. It will go a long ways in solving the budget deficit. Another really important thing we considered was we wanted this plan to be realistic. We realized the politics. We also realized the urgency of being able to balance our budget and yet try to do that without balancing it on the backs of senior citizens on fixed incomes and young families and farmers and small businesses across the state and still trying to protect essential services. So we're looking at a mechanism, a county option revenue reform that is identical to what has already been approved by the governor and by this legislature. This is the very same mechanism that funded the Twin Stadium, where if you recall back in 2006, there was a 0.15 sales tax that Hennepin County could impose. And if you also remember, there was no reverse referendum. We actually, in this proposal, go one step further. We're more conservative in actually requiring a reverse referendum. Another thing this bill does, it would eliminate the great inequities that we have with having 23 different local option sales taxes around the state. That's always been a concern of Chair Romcheski and I. In fact, we remember in last year's tax bill, we put a 2-year moratorium because we realized the great inequities. What this would do is, over time, ultimately eliminate all of the local option sales taxes other than cities of the first class, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and I can certainly talk about why that would be the case. We would eliminate those, and if counties option to do this, replace that with the county-wide.
Now, the countywide reduces the inequities, but we also have in here an equalizing factor that equalizes the differences between counties that can raise, has a lot more capacity to raise sales tax versus other ones. We try to mitigate those differences, and the runs you see will do that. So, members, I'm going to have Ms. Dalton just quickly kind of go through the major elements of the bill. But I think that this meets a lot of the criteria that we've talked about in this division and that we've talked about actually in tax committee. And that, number one, we need to solve the budget deficit. And number two, we need to try to reduce the impact on property taxpayers. We all agree we want to keep the economy intact by preventing job loss. And we all agree we want to provide quality of life to residents out around our state by maintaining important services. And also, it's been, I know, a strong theory in principle in here is local control, providing flexibility to our counties and cities. One other thing this allows, and of course, you know, cities, and they'll be testifying later, I'm sure, we're taking away the local option sales tax, ultimately. But one thing this does, we're able to save $100 million a year, which would be $100 million in this biennium and $200 million in the 12-13 biennium, is that it provides a lot more flexibility for this division to be able to protect a property tax refund program, and also will dramatically reduce the amount of cuts we need to make to local government aid. So we think this plan also helps strengthen, in that regard, the cuts, strengthens local government aid. So, you know, as we looked at this, we didn't just take it in a small context, we looked overall. And politically, again, we firmly believe this is something folks can support. And of course, we had the press conference yesterday, and I kind of always ignore the first 24 hours of comments, because we all have to put up our political guard, and immediately we can't say we like something. We understand the politics of everything. But I think when folks have a chance to really look at this plan and look at all the options that are out there when we try to meet a $6.4 billion hurdle, that this is going to look very good. And again, we look for ways in which this has been done in the past that has had support by the governor and both sides of the aisle, and we think that meets that requirement. It's the exact same mechanism. So with that, if Ms. Dalton would do a little explanation on the bill to cover more of the details, I'd appreciate that.
Ms. Dalton. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research, and I'm just going to take you through the bill summary. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill deal with levy limits. Section 1 essentially repeals levy limits for cities since they are not going to be benefiting from this additional revenue. Section 2 leaves the levy limits on counties for pay 2010. So it reduces, it repeals it for 2011. But what it does is it allows counties, if they choose not to impose a sales tax, they get to levy back any aid cut in pay 2010. If they choose to impose a sales tax, they will not be allowed to increase their property tax levy for their county program aid cut, because that money will actually be backfilled with the new local sales tax revenue. Section 3 is a cross-reference to the new county sales tax authority that's in Section 4. Section 4 allows counties the option of imposing a one-half sales tax subject to the reverse referendum. The money will go to the county general fund, and it will also go to pay for existing obligations for city local sales taxes that are preempted if a county imposes this tax. The rate is 1.5%. It's on both the general sales tax and on motor vehicle sales. The county is required to hold a hearing. There's 30 days for voters to petition for a reverse referendum. The reverse referendum is triggered by a petition with either 5% of signatures equal to 5% of the votes cast at the last general election, or 300 signatures, whichever is greater. The referendum can be held at a general or special election and must pass before the tax is imposed. The tax is administered the same way all the current local sales taxes are. The state collects it and then makes the payments back on a quarterly basis. And a county, if they choose to impose this tax, can only terminate the tax if all the obligations are met for the taxes that are preempted by the county imposing this tax. Section 5 is where we have the preemption of local sales taxes. If a county imposes tax under Section 4, any city that exists in that county that has a local sales tax, that tax is preempted. In the case of Hennepin County, Hennepin County's 0.15% twin stadium tax would be also preempted. The obligations that are funded by those city taxes and that existing county tax would then become the first obligation of this new county sales tax. That's where the revenue would have to go first. And any excess in above those obligations would then go into the county general fund. Subdivision.
May we take a question from Representative Grothwell, please?
Is that okay, Ms. Felton? Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. On the Hennepin County sales tax, I remember that, and maybe Representative Winchesky can correct me if I'm wrong, but there was some sort of increment with a growth in the sales tax above the amount needed to pay back the bonds went into a library program in Hennepin County, and there were some other benefits to Hennepin County. How would those be dealt with in this?
Ms. Felton, Madam Chair, Representative, they would be become an obligation of the county as well. That excess revenue that can go to libraries is limited to $4 million a year, and essentially what happens, so essentially to the extent that there are county obligations, that the money raised is sufficient to fund the Twin Stadium and the $4 million, that would continue to be an obligation.
Representative Grappler, are you done?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Proceed, Ms. Felton.
Subdivision 2 essentially just lays out how you determine how much of the county revenue from the half-cent sales tax has to go back to the cities, and it's based on what is currently being collected on those cities, and then it grows for growth in the county sales tax base. Subdivision 3 is the, as I said, it's a requirement that the Hennepin County tax be replaced and their obligations funded. Subdivision 4 deals with how you calculate the county share of obligations for cities that impose a sales tax that are split between two counties, two or more counties. We have two split cities that impose a local sales tax right now. One is the city of St. Cloud and the other one is the city of Mankato. This essentially provides a mechanism to determine what of those existing city obligations go to follow each county, and it also provides subdivision four, five, and six actually deal, subdivision four deals with a city entirely within the county. Subdivisions five and six deal with the split cities. And if, for example, in St. Cloud, which is split between three counties, if one county imposes a county tax and the other two counties doesn't, it essentially sets up a mechanism where you would establish a special taxing district in the area of the city that is not in a county imposing the tax, and the city tax would continue in that special taxing district. So it essentially keeps everybody whole in the case of split cities. Section 6 is where the reduction is made in county program aid. Everyone's county program aid is essentially frozen at the certified pay 2009 amount, and then it is reduced for one of two things. If a county does not impose a local sales tax, its aid is reduced by an amount equal to 3.58% of its 2009 levy plus aid base. 3.58 is halfway between the two percentages that the governor proposed of 2.8 and 3.98. This would raise, if no county imposed a local sales tax, the cut to county program aid under this provision would be $100 million. So that would be how much the state would save in county program aid. On the other hand, if a county does impose a local sales tax, the reduction to the county program aid is based on how much new money that they are going to get from the county sales tax after they meet the existing obligations for the preempted sales taxes. If a county's new money from local sales tax is less than $7 per capita, they will have no reduction in their county program aid. And then as their new money goes above $7 per capita, there's a 50% reduction based on the additional money up to $17 per capita, and a 75% reduction for new money above $17 per capita. So essentially this equalizes, the aid cuts to county program aid are a mechanism for equalizing the revenues that are achieved through this new half-cent sales tax. If every county imposed a half-cent sales tax, the county program aid reduction would be $124 million. And there would be about $105 million of new revenue over and above what is needed to offset the county program aid that counties can use to either further reduce property taxes or to fund whatever services the county wanted to. Section 7 is technical correction related to the appropriations. The appropriation amount is now determined by Section 6, but it does provide for continued payment of money to public defenders and for local input notes that are currently coming out of the county program appropriation. Section 8 repeals the formulas for the different portions of the county program aid. As I said, county program aid will be frozen at the paid 2009 amount. Eventually, you as the legislature will probably want to re-examine the county program aid formula and come up with a new formula that takes into account both property tax base and sales tax revenue. And finally, the other thing, paragraph B of the repealer repeals the existing authority for Cook County to impose a 1% sales tax for specific purposes. They are the only county that has an outstanding sales tax authority. They have not imposed this yet, so this is repealed and it's essentially replaced with the half-cent sales tax for general purposes.
Madam Chair, we're open for questions. Thank you, Ms. Dalton.
Members, any questions? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, a couple of clarifications. First of all, on Section 2, did I understand you correctly to be saying that that if the county chose to impose this tax, that their levy would in effect be frozen at its current level?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, no, what I said is that there will be a change in how the levy limit is calculated. You would still get the gross amount, but under current law, if there is an aid reduction, that increases your levy base, your levy limit itself, because you grow the levy limit base, which is levy plus aid, and then you subtract off the aid amount, and so you're subtracting off a reduced aid amount. We're saying that if you impose the local sales tax, you still get the growth in your levy limit, but you don't get to levy back the reduction in the county program aid, because that's being replaced with sales tax revenue, so you won't need to replace it with property tax revenue. On the other hand, if you don't impose the local sales tax, you get to levy back the county program aid. But in both cases, you get the growth factors that exist in the levy limit law.
Representative Lanning, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, well, that clarifies that question. The second question I have is on Section 5, Subdivision 3. Given the referendum requirement in this bill, or reverse referendum requirement, I assume that this does not give Hennepin County the right to now say we're not going to do the Twin Stadium. That obligation is still there. Even though some of my colleagues would like to see that happen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, if you look at Section 7, Subdivision 3, it says that if a county imposed a local sales, a county imposed local sales tax is preempted under Subdivision 1, and that's a Twin Stadium tax. The revenue from the tax imposed is first pledged to secure the bonds and obligations from the revenues from the preempted county sales tax. So the money first has to go pay the Twin Stadium.
Representative Lanning, do you have a follow-up?
No, but I'll have more questions later.
Thank you. Representative Lucchesi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me, Ms. Dalton, where in the summary is the 50% of the dollars raised if the locals, if the county commissioners vote to do this, and of course it's a voluntary choice, and if they survive a reverse referendum or their people don't want one, and then the money comes in, where is the 50% going to individual property tax relief in the summary? If half of it goes to the county to spend and half goes back to the taxpayer, where is that?
Madam Chair, Representative Lincoln, the 50% is actually a number that's based on statewide on average. Mm-hmm. That does not necessarily happen in every county. For instance, Olmsted County, 95% of the sales tax revenues in Olmsted County are in the city of Rochester. So 95% of a county sales tax would already be obligated to go pay the Rochester obligations under the local Rochester local sales tax. The new money for the county in Olmsted County is less than $7 per capita. Okay. They would see no county program aid reduction. That would just be all new money for them. On the other hand, under this proposal, even after you subtract off the obligations under the Twin Stadium, the sales tax revenue in Hennepin County is, on a per capita basis, is so large that it would completely wipe out county program aid in Hennepin County. Now, if you were going to do the governor's proposal, $27 million of county program aid would be wiped out, and this county would be increasing its property tax by $27 million to offset that aid loss. Under this proposal, the $33 million that's wiped out in here is offset with the sales tax revenue, so there's no property tax increase due to this aid cut. So that's where that goes to property tax relief.
Representative Lincoln, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's an important part that I don't see in the summary, but so people can understand that this is buying, you know, significant property tax relief as it plays out. But just one last question, and no. Madam Chair,
Representative Lincoln,
if that is the local options, he's signing it in the summary.
I'll wait.
Ms. Alden, did you find it in the summary?
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Lincoln, everyone is pointing out to me, and this is what happens when we do things really late in the day, part of the summary is missing. And that's why some of this information, it's in the bill, the summary is
a good call.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, and Ms. Dalton, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton has worked so hard on this proposal and trying to get everything for people, and I just think that's a really important part for understanding Representative Marquardt's proposal, is that as part of this providing a diversified revenue stream for the counties and sort of getting them off the instability of state whims, is in addition to the county being a beneficiary, the local taxpayers in the county are huge beneficiaries because their property tax increases won't go up because half of the revenue raised has to return to the taxpayers directly. So I'm sure that'll appear at a later summary, but if I may, my second question, Madam Chair.
Representative Lincoln.
And I think Ms. Dalton can help me with this, is when we were looking at this, One way, I think, to think about it, because people know that some of us don't like these low costs and sales taxes, they're not equalized, and they're they grow disparities between cities, and then the state has to raise more money and redistribute it in LGA and other things, because there's no offset in the LGA formula for local option sales taxes. So ridding ourselves of 20 of these taxes would be a great thing. But I think what's interesting to note is Ms. Dalton, I think, told Representative Marquardt and I that 57% of Minnesota is paying a local sales tax right now on a population basis. So it might be in sales tax. Maybe Ms. Dalton can talk to us a little bit about that. So people might think this is really new, but if you reside in Hennepin, you're paying it. If you reside in the greater regional center, you're paying it. And it's not equalized. And it's growing disparities. It's making things more unfair, where Representative Marquardt still actually has an equalizing factor so that you're diminishing disparities. So it's Ms. Dalton.
Ms. Dalton. Madam Chair, Representative Winteski, about one-third of the state population resides in cities that currently have a local sales tax. However, those local sales taxes aren't just paid by the population that resides in the city. 57% of the taxable sales in the state of Minnesota are currently paying some form of local sales tax as well as the state tax.
And Madam Chair, in relation to some of those, 26 other states allow this authority to counties to be able to levy an option sales tax. So there's 26 other states that do that. And when you look at if the counties go along with the option, basically the prevailing rate, when you include the 3/8 that was passed by the voters of the state, would be about 7.375. And there are 20 states in the nation that have a higher rate locally and statewide than that, or have the authority for a higher rate, 20 states.
Very good. Representative Marquardt, I have a quick question. Could you please refresh my memory as to what defines reverse referendum?
The way that would work is that once the county set the resolution to impose the FM option, people in the district or in the county would have 30 days to get petitions together to call for a reverse referendum, and that number that would be required would be 5% of all the voters at the last general election in that county, or 300 people, whichever number is greater.
Okay.
Ms. Dalton has something.
Ms. Dalton. Madam Chair, just to maybe help people put the summary together with the bill, what is missing out of the summary is the real sections 3 and 4. So the section that is numbered 3 should really be numbered section 5, and then just all the way down. So you're missing the actual summary for sections 3 and 4, and I apologize. So just move all the other numbers up too, and you'll have the summary for the right section of the bill.
Ms. Felton, would you just make sure that we all get that electronically yet today? So people know
that
will be in the
inbox.
I will
do the correction, and I will send it.
That would be great. So if anybody has any questions about that, they can check their email later today and get the updated summary. But you did a nice job going through the bill. We're not missing much.
Madam
people
Chair,
like Representative Winteski noticed.
And Madam Chair, as you know,
you're
the bill.
Great.
Madam Chair, the bill was introduced just yesterday, and we've been forcing in this since this is the last week of the division. So it's kind of the time,
exactly,
which I'm responsible for, and I will take the blame.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, Mr. Chairman, I know that there's been a lot of talk in taxes and property taxes as far as essential services and what they are, and I am wondering, does this bill do anything to help define what essential services are, since it uses the term? And I'll let you answer that. So,
Madam Chair, the bill itself does not use the term essential services, but I think you will have some county folks that can talk about essential services, but I think we all would have a definition: law enforcement, fire protection, health services, and that type of thing. But it's not defined actually in the bill.
Okay. Representative Lanning has a question, and then we'll move to public testimony. And I am going to make sure, start paying attention to the clock. Yeah, I'm close here to make sure that we're testifiers. Done it. Oh, you do?
Well, Madam Chair, I know there's testifiers.
Yes.
So, we have a lot of time.
So, Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, I'm not surprised by you again coming forward with a creative idea. You are good at doing that. But I must admit I'm surprised at a couple of features about this. Number one, you and I have both for a long time opposed local option sales taxes. And to see, you know, you come forward with a proposal to do local option sales tax is surprising to me. And then also, we've had a lot of talk about our regressive tax structure, and here we are looking at a proposal to, that's a regressive tax. Sales tax is a regressive tax. So I must admit, I'm surprised by those features. A couple of questions. This does not provide any kind of an offset for local government aid cuts. Is that the next proposal that we're likely to get some kind of idea here for how we're going to offset local government aid cuts?
Thank you, Senator, Madam Chair, and I, those are all great questions. And I do think this plan actually follows right along with the philosophy we had on why we eliminated the local option sales tax. The big concern that I know we had as chairs was the great inequities that were caused when you had cities. That was number one. And with counties, you first of all reduce the inequities, but then when we add this equalizing factor, I think if you look at the runs there before you, it really minimizes the great inequity. So that was number one. And the second huge concern we had is that there would be this offset for local government aid, because in states that tend to have a lot of local aid, they have little or no authority for these types of things. And in fact, this plan does offset. I mean, that's part of the idea, is that you are going to, as part of the equalization, you're going to offset county program aid, which allows us to get our savings. And ultimately, this will also eliminate all the local option sales taxes around. So as far as an offset for local government aid, that wouldn't even be considered. But that was one of the big concerns. The inequity, which I think this addresses, and the offset, which in fact we're doing in this bill. And to do things on a countywide basis would be a lot more of an equalizing factor than cities. The second thing is on the regressive nature. In the last couple of years, we've tried to provide property tax relief with a more progressive funding source. But again, one of the major reasons behind this bill is to make it realistic. And we know the governor is not going to accept income tax increases. I mean, that's just off the table. He also would not accept a statewide sales tax. We understand that also. But this is county local option sales tax. And not only has he approved 23 for cities of this very same nature, but one for Hennepin County, which is exactly the same, but actually less restrictive than what we are proposing today. One last point, too, is that in effect what we do is we replace, the counties have the option of replacing increases in property taxes with sales taxes. And why do I think that's better to do it that way? Is that in this tough economic times where you have people losing their jobs and trying to stay in their homes, the property tax is non-negotiable. They pay their property tax or they have to leave their home and they have to pull their kids out of the school and the neighborhood and so forth. You have more control over the sales tax. And remember, we're not expanding the base, so there's still no tax on clothing or food or other necessities. And so now I can have more leeway, and whether or not I want to purchase that, whatever that might be, I can say I can't do that. But with property taxes, I have actually no say. So as far as regressivity, sales tax and property tax are exactly the same. Would we like to incorporate more progressive taxes in trying to raise the revenue for this? Absolutely. But again, we're trying to be realistic with the plan.
Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, if I might follow
Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Representative Mullery. Representative Lanning has a follow-up. We'll let him go.
Thank you. Well, I guess we'll have that further discussion as we go along here. One of the aspects of the current local option sales tax, and one of the criteria that we've used, is that to fund projects of regional significance. And as I understand this, that would no longer be possible, so that a county, if for them to fund a major facility that has regional significance, they would no longer have this option. They would have to use property tax or other means to fund that.
Madam Chair,
Representative
Lanning, a county could still do that if they wanted. I mean, they are allowed to use that half cent that they would bring in, and they could, you know, if a city has something going on or there's a regional influence, they could still fund that through this sales tax.
Representative Lanning.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. But that would compete then for their normal uses of county program aid replacement. The last thing, and then I'll let the testifiers come forward, if I might. for those of us along the border, increasing the sales tax, in my view, is no option at all. We're already in our county higher than Cass County in North Dakota, and it becomes very difficult to justify raising the sales tax even more to make it higher in comparison. So I raised this question with Ms. Dalton as well, and you know, it seems to me if we want to eliminate the disparities here, Madam Chair, we've got to keep in mind that we've got some real significant border disparity issues that are going on around the state as well.
Madam Chair, I think that's a very important point, and one I seriously considered. First of all, the sales tax is exactly the same between Fargo and Moorhead right now at 6.5%, because Fargo has a 1.5% local option. I think the huge competitiveness along the border is not sales tax, but property taxes. That's where we have the competitive edge right now. And City of Moorhead does a study every year where they look at all the taxes, and we actually come out a little better in Minnesota side because we have lower property taxes. And I think that's where we stay competitively. In North Dakota right now is looking at, Governor Hogan had a proposal to reduce property taxes by $300 million. And if they go through with that, and we've got rising property taxes, it's going to put us at a huge disadvantage along the border. One thing you also have to remember is that, you know, Wahpeton, which is next to Breckenridge, has 6.5%. Fargo has 6.5%. Grand Forks, along East Grand Forks, is 6.75%. And the thing to remember is they tax clothing. And the legislature was thinking of exempting clothing, but it was defeated in the Senate like 58-1 or something like that. So they're going to still keep that. And that, as far as the effective tax rate, really moves their rates up over 7%. So I don't see that as a competitive disadvantage at all if a county along the border was to levy this. But that's something the county's going to have to decide. It's local control. But the real competitiveness, I think, along the border is property taxes, and we need to keep those low.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like there's a lot of throwing around inequity term. First of all, you're talking about what other states do with regard to this. There's another way to reduce the property tax, and that would be allow local income taxes like many states do. A lot of cities in this country have local income taxes, so I don't see any consideration of what a lot of states do to achieve a more progressive system rather than making it more regressive, which this seems to do. Second of all, I don't know, when you're saying inequities, we're getting rid of the inequities. The inequities under the present system from the state may be actually to level out inequities in the actual institutions or the entities. Most of the places that have a sales tax right now, local taxes, are cities that have a lot of problems. And to some extent, I don't see, you know, Bloomington or Edina in the same issues that Minneapolis-St. Paul have, or Brooklyn Center, or certain types of places like that. So you're talking about all this inequity, but the inequity is underlying, and what the state was trying to do is get at that. And in most cases, now there's a couple suburbs, I guess, I don't know how many, but that have in the statewide that have sales taxes, but most don't. And it sounds almost like you're getting into the same thing of some of the really rich school districts that don't want to have any more per pupil aid going where it's really desperately needed. And so inequities in a tax out there is a lot different from inequities in what's needed, and I thought as a state we were trying to get at the needs for those types of problems in the state. And I know that the fiscal disparities always bothers Bloomington for sending 20-some million every year directed to St. Paul, but there are needs that a lot of these things are designed at, and I'm not sure it's good to gloss over there to get a quote inequity in a certain area.
Representative Mallory, was that a question or a comment?
I think there were some questions in it, too.
Would you extract those and get on the...
Well, these are points. Do you disagree with them? Right off the bat, there's no consideration of the progressivity of an income tax, local income tax. There's
Representative
Mallory,
some of the
other
things.
Not consider local income tax.
Okay, thank you. And people in the audience, I just need to get a quick survey of how many people would like to testify on this bill. Would you please raise your hands? Okay, about four. And then would you start moving down this way and sit in one of the first rows so that we can move quickly? And in the meantime, Representative Lanning, would you like to ask your question to Representative Marquardt? You had a last question, correct?
Well, Madam Chair, it was just a clarification on existing tax. The voters of Minnesota just added another 3/8 of 1% that goes into effect later this year. And so in the case of the border that I'm talking about, we're going to be that much higher already, and that was my point. And this 0.5% would be on top of the 3/8 of a percent that was added in Minnesota this year.
Yes, the county so too. Okay. Testifiers, would you please try to limit your comments to 2 minutes so that we can get out at noon? We have floor session at 12:30, so we need to make sure that we stay very punctual today. Thank you, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Obviously, we've been given a lot to digest here, so I'll just make a couple of broad comments. AMC has had a long standing position that we do support the authority for counties to impose a local option sales tax. We also agree with the concept that we need to have a diversified revenue stream, and I think that's something that we're very interested in. The other interactions in the bill, I think, it frankly has given us a lot to consider, and we're going to be discussing this with our board and developing a full position. But I just want to be clear that it's something we're looking at. I think that there are some concerns among our members about how this would interact. I think those have been voiced by various members of the committee already. I think Representative Lanning's comments for border folks is one. Another concern we've heard has been whether or not the public appetite will be there to actually sustain these, or if the reverse referendum would result in a cut in program aid with nothing to replace it. So those are some of the preliminary reactions we had, but again, I think it's a very interesting proposal, and I want to thank Representative Marquardt for putting it out there, and I think it's something that we're going to be looking at very intently over the next several days. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. And I want to thank Representative Marquardt for putting this proposal forward. Our organization also has a position supporting local option sales taxes. And this proposal obviously contains that. But we do have some important caveats that we want to mention in the committee's consideration. First, as counties have frankly already been there and done that. For those of you who don't have a long history around here, back in the early 1990s, every county in the state was asked to approve a 0.5% increase in the sales tax, with the proceeds from that being dedicated to a local government trust fund. basically a gun was held to her head and said, if you don't do this, aids to both you and cities will be cut. Every county acquiesced to that, and the tax was put into effect. But 2 short years later, the rug was pulled out from under us, and that local government trust fund was eliminated, and aids and credits to counties and cities were subsequently cut. So there's a lot of concern about, are we just going to find ourselves in exactly the same place again? Further concern we have with the bill is with the reverse referendum feature. Many times the authors have compared this to the Hennepin County stadium tax or the metropolitan transit tax. Neither of those bills had a reverse referendum feature. I think what is intended here is that you want us to pass these taxes so we can help you out by minimizing the property tax impacts of the aid cuts. Well, if you want us to do that, I would suggest that you strongly consider following those two prior models, because if you leave the reverse referendum as it is in here, it will be petitioned in many instances, and what we fear is going to occur is that we're going to end up with a patchwork, that some counties will have the tax, the next county over won't have the tax, and that will further heighten the concerns of some county boards as they pass this tax. We would suggest at the very least that you might consider a provision that says, if you will consent to provide X amount of property tax relief or limit your property tax increase to X percent, that you don't have to go through the reverse referendum. Finally, just a final concern with the mechanics of the bill. Dealing with the cities who have already chose to exercise this authority, we have to provide all the funds to them. That's the first call on these monies, and that's fine. But what happens in the future when the city says, well, now we have another project? This is being marketed on the fact that we're going to get that money. But the pressures are going to be great on us in those cities that have existing taxes. Well, now we have a set of projects that need to be funded. So the promises of new revenues, new property tax relief for counties aren't necessarily. I'll finally just mention the bill eliminates levy limits on cities while counties are continued to be subject to it. And we appreciate why that's there, but you're asking us to do a lot of heavy lifting under this bill. And there is an equity issue there, why we should continue to be subject to levy limits while cities are not.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And you may proceed. Welcome to the division.
Good morning. My name is Jean Diedrich. I'm a principal child support officer with Hennepin County Social Services. I'm a 28-and-a-half-year employee of Hennepin County, so I've seen a lot of stuff come and go during my service with the county. This is the worst that I've ever seen at Hennepin County. Have, and it's not just Hennepin County, Ramsey County, the counties around the state, have seen a decrease in local government aid. We've seen a decrease in targeted case management funding. We've seen a decrease in monies coming into our hospitals. We've just seen decreases. We've been hit time and time again. I'm saying this really fast. We are to the point where we're doing less with less. If we are to serve the residents of the state of Minnesota, the residents of our counties, we need money. We are to the point where we cannot provide for safe and healthy communities, social services. We're serving the most vulnerable members of our community. If we can get 1,500 positions not cut, that means that our residents are going to be served. We will be able to serve child protection clients. We will be able to serve child support clients. We will be able to serve eligibility support. We have double families and parents coming in to apply for services who've never been applying for public assistance before, for MFIP, for Diversionary Work Program, for food support. We have to have the people there to provide those services. Right now, I can tell you that in Hennepin County, we have had vacancy rates, and we're to the point where we're looking at cutting at least 60 positions in social services. Our caseloads are already going up, and we can't provide adequate services to protect children. Child support. We've had cuts in child support where we can't provide adequate services to get cases done on a timely fashion. Eligibility support. People are waiting longer to have a determination on whether or not they're going to get assistance. And sometimes when they've been working and all of a sudden they have no income, that's the difference between staying in their home. And the whole point is we serve vulnerable adults, veteran services. We serve veterans coming back. We serve the widows or the widowers of people who are passing away. If there's any ability to keep those services going and to keep our positions through this program where it doesn't have an adverse impact on the taxpayers, it would be a good thing. And I can't stress strongly enough that the workers of providing these services are really tired of doing less with less. We take great pride in doing the work that we do, doing it in a fashion that's timely, cost-efficient. Uncompensated care at the medical center and hospitals around the state. We can't keep doing that because the taxpayers keep paying for it.
Thank you, Deidre.
So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming to testify. Mr. Carlson.
Very quickly, Madam Chair, my name is Gary Carlson, League of Minnesota Cities. The League has an interest in this bill because we do also support local revenue diversification for cities, and we have supported that in light of, as Representative Marquardt or as Representative Lanning indicated, to fund capital projects of regional significance, and I think that this bill would make it much more difficult for future projects to occur. We do support the Section 1 repeal of levy limits for cities. We've already spoken to that issue today as well. But most importantly, and perhaps additionally, the flip side of Mr. Keith Carlson's comments, we want to make sure that the satisfaction of pre-existing obligations for cities under Section 7 includes everything that cities have already been obligated to spend money for in terms of these capital projects that have already been approved. I want to make sure that those cities look at the language that's contained in the bill to make sure that they feel that they're not exposed to the fact that counties would now assume the imposition of the sales tax. Madam Chair, that concludes my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Marquardt, do you have any just one second. Anybody else from the audience who wants to testify for or against? Sir, would you come down, please?
Madam Chair,
nice to see you again. Please state your name for the record.
David Sadler. I am a resident of Minneapolis, Southwest Minneapolis. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Federation Tax Committee. We are been very active around here, as all of you know, bringing concerns about the property tax situation. And I want to say one thing that's important is Minnesota Senior Federation feels very strongly that we have to be a nonpartisan organization. We have to approach these issues independently and have a chance to have our own independent thoughts and objective look at things. With that, having said that, I'd like to support some of the things that Representative Marquardt has mentioned. And what we're looking at right now is the most recent tax incident study. If you take a look at that, you can see that the lower decile in Section 5, there's a number of tables in there that show that regressivity has gone up pretty dramatically in the last couple of years. There's a summary chart in there that we're getting back to a hockey stick situation where the lower decile income people are having to support much more of the tax burden. And there's also Catherine's work on the dashboard. We have this dashboard that was put together that was a pretty creative piece of work that shows, again, it's about a 30% jump in regressivity. Now, the thing I'd say is, as you pointed out, property taxes have nearly doubled since 2002, whereas no other taxes have gone up nearly that much. I mean, I don't think the income taxes have gone up, and the sales taxes have only gone up a little bit. So that regressivity increase and trend that we're seeing out of the numbers from the Department of Revenue is almost 100% because of property tax increases. And that's really a problem. That is a serious problem that we have to address.
Thank you, Mr. Sadler. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, and I really appreciate this discussion. You know, is this a perfect plan? No. But I think as we look at the options out there, that you're going to see that this is a very viable one, it's a serious one, that is going to protect jobs, property taxpayers, and essential services. And so we put this out there, and appreciate all the discussion today, and I would renew my motion to lay over
House File 2020 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division.
House File 2020 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. And members and people in the audience, I would just like to remind you that we are not adjourning because we are reconvening tonight at 6 o'clock. So we stand in recess. Thank you.
Thank you, members. I'll call the
Program. Right now there's probably roughly about 200 statewide. It's not a program that's used very often, and we're trying to open up the qualifications a little bit, and hopefully that will get a few more people in the program. So this bill does three things. Right now, currently, to qualify, both spouses have to be 65 years of age. This would say one at least has to be 65, but the other one could be 62. The other one could be younger by a few years. The second thing would raise the household income qualification from $60,000 to $75,000. And the third would be that the interest on the deferment that would be paid back, currently it's at a 5% rate, and this would lower it to a 3% rate. So three things to try to, and I think this maker is this almost identical to the requirements we had in last sessions. So I think other than I think we had zero for the interest rate.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're having 3%.
Any questions? It's an easy bill. Anyone in the audience would like to speak for or against the proposal? Come on up to the table. And introduce yourself for the record.
I'm speaking on behalf of myself. And we have in support of the bill. I'm a senior. I am a member of the Minnesota Seniors Federation. This is not a topic that we discussed very much, but I've taken an interest in it. And I believe it's a good step in the right direction. I would have a couple more comments, suggestions as far as what I think would be improved the bill. And I'll just get right into those now. Most seniors.
Just for the purposes of people might listen on the tape, could you give us their name?
Oh, I'm sorry. David Sadler, resident of Minneapolis, Southwest Minneapolis. One of the things that we would suggest is to reconsider the 15-year residence requirement. Studies show that it's not unusual. You know, senior people do make plans for retirement and their senior living circumstances, and there's a lot of resettlement around the age as people go into retirement or just before it. So with that in mind, then you have a situation where with the 15-year requirement that we have now, you're going to be 75 or 80 years old before you qualify for the bill, and we believe that that's one of the reasons why it hasn't been used so much. It's just because of that one requirement. So we believe that it would be improved the bill quite a bit if that requirement could be reduced to 5 years or even 10 years. I think it's to go along with that, I suggest a requirement for Minnesota residency for being in the state for some extended period of time qualifying. I think it would be nice to be able to transfer that thing, because seniors do and occasionally have to move, downsize, or relocate, and to lose that benefit would not be so good. There was also some talk about having a lifetime limit on the accumulation of the deferred property tax. that seem like a good idea, where it would be limited to 50% of the market value of the property. That's been discussed in the past as an improvement. And also, to make a point here, is that our senior discussions, I mean, nobody wants to avoid, really, doesn't want to avoid property taxes. They want to participate in the community. They want to be able to support the community. So we're not looking at a situation here where we're trying to get away from it altogether. And so I think it would be good if the program would allow to continue to have partial payment for the property taxes up to the point where they can handle it. So then we create a situation where the homeowners, the senior homeowners, have a way to manage their expenses and yet still support the community and not push everything off to the end of the estate process. So those are the suggestions I make.
Anyone else who'd like to testify for or against this bill? If not, Representative
Markport,
would you like to
take
a closing comment?
Well, thank you very much. I'm just going to move today over House File 1975 to pass the provision.
Thank you so much, and we will lay
it
over for consideration.
Well, thank you very much.
And I have heard that Representative Kahn is on her way. Should we wait a minute, or should I go forward with mine?
All right, Representative Laughlin, you're on the committee, so you, Representative Laughlin, moves 19 House Bill 1906 for possible inclusion in the property tax revision report. Representative Laughlin, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the page will be sending out a couple of pieces of information put together by our tax staff to further illustrate the issues that we will address. This bill has two components for being efficient use of staff time, and they both deal with rental property, but deal with it a couple of different issues. The first provision would put a moratorium on any new relative homestead. This is where someone buys a property and has a relative living in it, and that would qualify the property for a homestead status. It would not qualify, however, for the rent credit under our current relative homestead provision. And it would not discontinue any current relative homesteads. It would just simply say, going forward, we're not going to have any more in the non-agricultural property. And this issue was brought to my attention by a number of neighborhood groups in our area, and having talked to people who represent campus areas across the state, there are an increasing conversion of single-family homes to rental for the purposes of short-term accommodations of students while someone's attending college. And it's had a particularly devastating impact in many residential neighborhoods that were designed to be the quiet single-family homes for the people who are living in the community long-term. And there was oftentimes rental properties, duplexes, apartment buildings, really designed for student housing. And what has happened is that because of the tax advantage, as well as other financial considerations, parents will buy a nice single-family home, and they'll move their son or daughter into it, and then they'll invite four or five or more roommates in to pay rent on it. And all of a sudden, what had been a quiet single-family home in the community all of a sudden has is a rental property with a lot of people in it. It doesn't take out a rental license. It doesn't tend to have to adhere to the other requirements. And in particular, in some of the communities in Northeast, which I represent, which has 7,700 rental properties of various types, and Southeast, which represents the Conn represents in near the university, we have seen almost, in some areas, almost all single-family homes converting. And it's really changed the character of the neighborhood. And I did have a testifier who was going to try and make it here, but she said she gave me some written testimony in case she wasn't able to get here in time. I just checked her down in room 10. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to read into the record some comments about that.
There are multiple issues that impact my community and encourage the trend towards fewer homesteaded properties, more absentee owned rental properties. My encouragement of this trend has been the relative homesteading change.
Representative Loeffler, my apologies. I see that Representative Kahn is in the room, so maybe if we want to show proper deference and respect to the senior member, Representative Kahn, we could.
Mr. Chairman, you're in charge of this. I must say, I would look at the calendar to see what bills are in front of the esteemed Representative Kahn's committee.
Representative Loeffler, I'll allow you to use your discretion. At, the respect you would show the chairman of the State Government Finance Committee. I'm going to recognize that you didn't be at the mic, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Fantastic.
Representative Loeffler, do you have any closing comments?
The other issue that's addressed in this bill is the classification of rental property. And you may have noticed when the governor's budget was presented and he had some proposals on renter's credit. We have two handouts that illustrate how one unit, two to three units in apartment buildings can really vary in terms of their tax experience as well as the market value growth over the last 7 years, and with double-digit increases primarily with the smaller units and lesser single-digit increases, a high of 6% for the apartment buildings. And that has, I think, contributed to what's illustrated by the other handout, which is statewide, 1 to 3 units pay 18% of their rent in taxes, while statewide, 4 or more units are at 11%. And it clearly demonstrates, I think that there's some inequity in how these properties are being taxed. It may have to do with the fact that they're valued differently. The small buildings, it tends to be at comparable sales. The larger buildings, it's rent capitalization. And what this bill would do would be changing the 2 and 3 unit rentals to the same as the single family rentals while holding the apartments where they are. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Loeffler, any questions from the members of the committee? Seeing none, this is an open hearing. Is there a public hearing? Are there any members of the public who should testify for or against? Hi, welcome. Please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now we'll know who you are.
Hi, my name is Chris Galler with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. The Minnesota Association of Realtors is here to speak against House File 1906 as it pertains to the elimination of the relative homestead provision and to speak for the sections that would reduce the class rates for duplexes and triplexes. Although this might seem like an inconsistent position, it's based upon the Minnesota Realtors' long-term effort to bring fairness to the property tax system. Since property taxes are not levied based upon an owner's ability to pay, progressivity can be skewed by the decisions of individual homeowners. The relative homestead classification was adopted in the mid-1990s to recognize and reinforce the appropriate actions being taken by relatives to provide housing to those less fortunate within the family. Instead of turning to government for Section 8 or other housing assistance, this program granted the owner homestead privileges on the property of a needy relative in order to provide good shelter. It is important to remember that the tax rate on non-homesteaded property at the time was 3 times higher than that for owner-occupied property. This is an important reminder in light of the discussions you've been having about tax expenditures. Representative Marquardt questioned my colleague yesterday about scenarios where two people own similar properties. It wasn't uncommon in the mid-1990s for an owner-occupied property identical to the neighboring property that was rented to have taxes 3 times as high. At that time, we started to lobby a number of issues related to tax fairness. One of them was the relative homestead provision, which was strongly supported by the Minnesota Realtors and our House is a House initiative. And it was the first major move to recognize that homes should be taxed by their value and that government policy should encourage families to depend upon relatives before turning to the government. Retaining the minimal homestead benefits that are currently in place for family members who are willing to help another family member. Those family members can be facing foreclosure, short sales, job loss, sickness, or a whole range of other issues is a policy that legislators embrace. We do not feel that
changing legislation at this point is going to have any dramatic impact on college housing situations. I think it's a great effort. I understand the strife in that area, but we believe you're going to discourage others from helping family members. To that extent, we also are supporting the reducing the tax burden for non-homesteaded duplexes and triplexes. Minnesota, especially parts of the metro, are experiencing a wave of foreclosures and short sales. These families have damaged credit histories and will need to find affordable rental options. It is important that government not penalize these families further by having them pay a higher property tax rate. So with that, we have to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Saying none, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would just respond that, well, it once upon a time was a big difference. Right now, the difference is $312, which is about $25 a month.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify either for or against this bill? Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Good evening, I'm Stephen Baker, the Branson County Assessor, and I'm here speaking to you for the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And I guess my comments will just be that our association would see this primarily as a policy question that we would not really weigh in on either way, whether we're also homestead or the REITs, whatever the legislature wants to say. What I would like to point out is that the relative homestead, I think, is an ever increasingly difficult part of our tax system's administration. We have many more non-traditional families now who find it's difficult sometimes to really document whether somebody is a relative. Names are confusing, and due to some changes in, especially some of the city inspection codes, there's sometimes a desire to get a property homesteaded to avoid some of those inspections. And we see a relative homestead that probably has a higher level of use, perhaps, than a regular homestead. So to the extent that that information helps you decide what to do there. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Baker? Representative Scott.
I have a question for Mr. Baker, but just for the author, perhaps. My husband and I own a couple of rental properties. One of them being in St. Paul, it's a duplex. And the property taxes there have gone up so substantially that not only does it not cash flow anymore, but what happens when, obviously, when the property taxes are raised, we're forced to raise our rent and make the housing less affordable. So we need to look at what our goals are here and not, defeat one purpose and lose another, I think. So that was just a comment I guess I had.
Is there an additional testifier in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Loeffler, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to have you laid over
to that. Representative Loeffler moves House File 1906 for possible inclusion, or renews her motion to have House File 1906 laid over for possible inclusion. Thanks. Representative Kahn, welcome to the committee. Representative Kahn, do you have someone to move your bill? Representative Loeffler moves House File 1403 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division Committee Report. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, there is an amendment that was put to the bill that was shared with the House in the past. This is the side of the passage. We can get out of the problem. But let me explain something. I mean, I don't think Walker has done something for you that said that.
Well, we can meet your objectives, Representative Kahn, if you so desire.
Which took language from essentially from the local government's aid administration and put it in the state auditor's office, the state auditor's responsibility, which they could not legitimate. The state auditor acts mostly on a fee basis for local governments that they deal. So this is for looking for some issues. Or the issues of destruction and so forth. They couldn't deal with bills to a locality. because of the fact that vendors will probably get no reports reporting them for sitting with them in the building. So this was an arrangement that was made with a previous, many years ago, with a previous tax when we announced that to cover that appropriation to the employee workers office. Because as people on the committee may be aware, the state government finance department does not have any sentimental attachment to any of the appropriations. In fact, people like to talk about how much they're able to cut state government, even though they're cutting things that like the checks and the things that collect the revenue that manages to drive state government. So, we decided that the way that this was funded is then taking a very small amount off the top of a very large number. A previous tax chair had agreed to do that, and then Representative Jackie had also agreed to do it when we increased it from 217,000 to 214,000.
Representative Pan, did you want somebody?
Just putting the bill together.
Do you want us to move the A1 amendment or not?
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think you want to. But in the course of putting the bill together, the whole section was taken out of the tax bill. And what happened was the money that we needed was left as part of the putting as part of the ordinary bill. So, we've lost this kind of easy way of getting money, but we do have the money in the day. So it's sort of up to the tax committee as to whether they want to see. And the whole, the bill was written up in a way that didn't really make sense. It restored all the language, and all we wanted to do was restore part of it. So it's kind of, I am happier by just leaving the issue in your hands. You have to make sure that it's not double funded in any way. But if you want to keep doing it by this amount off the top, or if you want to leave it in the base, our problem is that we run into problems. Our base is not considered a tax increase. But it's certainly, for this year, it's been shaping our budget. That makes the spirit of anybody.
Representative Marquardt, do you have a comment?
Well, Mr. Chair, if we want to make it safe, we've got to put it in the education bill.
Representative Kahn. Any other questions or comments for Representative Kahn? Representative Loeffler.
Well, I know that part of this is to fund the state marketer's office, and I'm hoping that Representative Kahn will be looking to significantly make sure that office is able to do a good and fair census count so that our local government aid are distributed appropriately, and also so that Minnesota doesn't lose the congressional seats that are within 5,000 people of losing it. So I hope all of you will join me in trying to recruit 5,000 more people into Minnesota before next spring.
Before we do that, is there any other questions or comments from legislators? Seeing that this is a public hearing, is there any members of the public or from the Revenue Department who wish to testify for or against this bill? Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jason Miller with the Department of Revenue. And we included the repeal of this provision in our technical policy from last year because of the confusion that this is hand kind of surfacing on how exactly this provision is supposed to work and how people believe it's working. So certainly I don't have any objection to Representative Klein's voters to make sure that the funding is available for these purposes. But so the way this provision actually works is there's always really awkward way.
That clears things up.
to do an appropriation. So hopefully it's not a mechanism that is that returns, but certainly you can see what they need to do.
Thank you. Representative Kahn, any closing comments? Thank you very much. Representative Laughlin, renews her motion to have House File 1403 laid over for possible inclusion in the property tax division report. Thank you. And is anyone here to move Representative Atkins' bill? Representative Lanning, have you thoroughly read the minutes from March 17th? Representative Lanning, I move approval of the minutes from March 17th. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. I'll move Atkins' bill. I'm going to discuss it before he gets here. Or is anyone read Representative Atkins' bill?
Mr. Chair, today in government operations, Representative Dill had his demon fish bill that had to go through there for whatever reason, and he did not show up. So we have someone from the DNR give about 2 minutes of testimony and pass right through. So I think that's set an example that if you actually don't show up in government ops, you have a better chance of getting your bill out. But I've seen some other ones where you've got authors who are passionate and they won't go down. But
Representative Marquardt, do you feel comfortable moving Representative Atkins' bill?
I certainly feel comfortable moving it. I wouldn't want to talk to it, but
I can talk about Representative Marquardt.
I don't know how much did we check and see how long he might be? Did we know? Okay. What we could do, if it was going to be very long, if we could just put it on tomorrow's agenda.
Okay, I like your style, Mr. Chairman.
So why don't we, what I'm thinking is maybe about 5 minutes to just figure out, let me head down there, we can figure out exactly what type of a bill it is. It sounds like he may have a controversial bill and it's a simple one. Let's just adjourn tonight and come back tomorrow. But let's just have someone check and see what type of bill it is.
Does someone want to run down that?
Okay, we'll do that. So it's all right with the chair. Let's just pull up a few minutes.
So Representative Marquardt, what's new? Representative Atkins, your bill has been amended.
Mr. Chair, it is with vigor and enthusiasm that I'd like to move House File 1416 for a possible inclusion into the
Thank you. Representative Marquardt, who's House File 1416 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division Report. Representative Atkins, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for your patience. I apologize for I was actually chairing a committee of my own and having a difficult time being dragged out of there. But this is actually the summary that has been prepared by the staff. It's an excellent job. You've got some folks, and I don't actually know if they're here to testify with me tonight or not because I just walked in the room. But you got some folks that are literally being eaten alive by the situation that they're in right now. And if we don't do something, there's not going to be something left to do. We've got a number of folks that are up against it as far as the taxes that they pay, the property that this applies to, as the summary says, is it just applies to the Class 4C, the Lakeshore property and the surrounding land used by a marina, which is accessible to the public, devoted to recreational use for marina services. And the value of this land is going up exponentially in spite of the market that we're in and all of that. And folks are paying more and more and more in terms of their taxes, and they are not doing all that great financially. It recognizes that this land is not going to be put to some dramatically higher use that would justify a higher tax rate. So this just provides that it will be extended to Class 4C tax treatment. And with that, there may well be testimony that I'm not aware of quite yet, but otherwise I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Members, are there any questions for Representative Atkins? Representative Lopler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to few notes that perhaps the assessor's unit or the Department of Revenue Council and give us some idea. I mean, I think of what Lake Malax, nothing but marinas all the way around the lake, and there might be some local governments that just have a hard time with this, that aren't quite in the situation at the middle of the lake.
Representative Loeffler, it's a fair concern, but I believe what would occur, and I'm sure the staff will verify this, is that it would cause some folks to be taxed a little bit less, and then the balance spread over other taxpayers. You have a situation now, though, where you're paying, I think it's 1.5 times the Class 3A that they're classified now currently as a Class 3, 1.5% of the first 150, and then 2% over that. And it's just pricing right out of business. If we truly believe that this is part of Minnesota Nice, Minnesota, the quality of life that we have and the amenities that we have in Minnesota, we have to do. So we've got to step up and make sure that we don't have these folks going out of business.
This isn't a public hearing, so are there any people in the audience who wish to testify either for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Atkins, any closing comments?
I think you've got a good summary of it. If you'd like, I can have you bombarded with comments from folks. There really is. The people who brought this to me take it very, very seriously. And no offense to the notice that we have, but it's hard for them to find their way here. If you'd like, I can have them get lots and lots of emails for you. But I think it suffices to say that they're in and you've heard others testify relative to the concerns that they have and the situations that they're in. Just appreciate your support for the bill.
That Representative Marquardt renews his motion to have House File 1416 laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division Report. Thanks, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt, anything else? With that, the committee will be adjourned. Thanks.
Thank you.